science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Yes, indeed. It is time for Dear Science with Ellen. How are you, Ellen, today?
I'm very well. How are you, Lisa?
Good. Good. Getting there.
All the kiddies are back at school, by the look of it.
Yeah.
Yes,
oh, yeah,
it's
no,
a very
it is...
different place around here when the students are around.
So. I was liking it.
The kiddie kiddies are still on holiday, though.
Oh, the kiddie kiddie. Oh, yes, indeed. Yes, yes.
Yeah, I was liking it when the campus was quiet. That was great. Don't have
there
to
no
wait in line.
Wardens.
Yeah, don't have to wait in line for food. It was just great. Sorry, my microphone is actually falling down. It's pretty annoying. Anyway, science today. So, first topic, we start with something called neutrino.
Yeah.
And you wanted me to ask what it was.
Did I?
I think in the email you were like, you might want to ask what it is.
No.
So what is it?
that was just a rhetorical question. But, okay, so long-time listeners may remember back to about 2015 or so, and the big thing then was gravitational waves. And they managed to detect some gravitational waves that came from a couple of colliding black holes that were about 1.5 billion years away from us. And as a result of that, three people, I think, got the Nobel Prize in Physics last year. So this is possibly a discovery of similar magnitude. But what they've done is that they have used a neutrino detector to be able to pinpoint where in the universe this neutrino came from. Okay,
wow.
So your question, what is a neutrino? Okay, so we should start with that. Okay, so your atoms are made up of electrons, protons, and neutrons, okay?
Yep.
That's the Rutherford model of the atom. Sadly, there's a whole bunch of smaller particles that make up those things, particularly in the nucleus. And one of those is a thing called a neutrino. And neutrinos are really, really, really weird because of the fact, number one, they haven't got any charge, which is not quite so weird in itself. But the other thing is that they are really, 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 really light. Okay. And some people think, in fact, they've got no mass at all. Okay. So if you can get your head around the concept of a particle that has no mass, you're probably doing better than I am. Anyway.
And they're in the nucleus.
Well, that's an interesting question, actually. Yeah. Again, some people would argue that they don't exist sort of while they are attached to things, and then during radioactive decay, they then get spat out. In fact, during beta decay, which is the way that carbon-14 decays. But the amazing thing about neutrinos, okay, but that they're so tiny and they have no charge, so that means they don't interact with matter pretty much at all. Okay, and the story that's always told about neutrinos is that you can take a length of lead, a lead cylinder that is one light year in length, okay, and that's around about 9 trillion kilometers. Okay, now you know how you use lead when you're getting an X-ray, and lead stops all of those nasty X-rays, you know, so you're getting a mouth X-ray or whatever, you get a lead sheet on you, and that stops those particles. Okay, you can take this lead, this cylinder of lead that's a light year in length, and you can shoot neutrinos down it, and half of them will come out the other end.
Oh.
Okay, so they really don't interact with matter very easily at all.
Yeah.
So what these people in the States have done is they've got a neutrino detector. They've built a neutrino detector. Gosh,
yes.
It's Wednesday at the South Pole. And this neutrino detector occupies about 1 cubic kilometer of ice.
Okay.
Into which they've sunk these detectors that can basically detect light, essentially, or radiation. And they've got that all rigged up so that if they do detect a neutrino, it will immediately sort of tell people around the world that, yep, they've got that neutrino. We kind of know where it came from. Point your telescopes in this particular direction. Okay? And that's exactly what they did. So they're really, really lucky to see a neutrino. And again, to sort of emphasize this, neutrinos are everywhere. They are hoofing through us at a rate of knots even as we speak. So roughly, for every square centimeter of the planet, there's about 65 billion neutrinos going through it per second.
That's quite a lot.
Yeah. So we through our bodies, we've got literally trillions of neutrinos going every second, but they just go straight through.
Yeah.
Okay, they just don't interact with anything. So it's very, very rare that you can actually get some sort of interaction of matter with a neutrino. But they managed to do this. They got this lone neutrino, which in order to see it had to have interacted with matter. So that's a very, very unusual and very, very unlikely thing to actually happen. It does happen, but it's very, very unusual. And they managed to get this at the South Pole. And then, as I said, within 43 seconds, the signal had gone to around the world saying, we've found a neutrino. This is where we think it came from. Point your telescopes in that particular direction. So we've got this orbiting telescope, which is a gamma ray space telescope, the Fermi gamma ray space telescope. And so it pointed its gamma ray cameras in this particular direction, and they found where this neutrino came from. And so this was a thing called a blazar.
What is this?
I have to say I'd never heard of a blazar before. I'd heard of a quasar, but a blazar is essentially... It's a galaxy that's got a really, 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 really energetic core. And it's spitting out... Yeah, indeed. And it's spitting out lots and lots of particles, but it's spitting them out in the direction of the Earth, which is kind of lucky because it could be spitting them out in any old direction in the universe. And this is 4.5 billion light years away. Okay, this is you know, we're talking a long way away. And... And, you know, this is the first time that they've used this neutrino detector to be able to figure out where in the sky it came from.
Yeah.
And, you know, quite remarkable stuff. It might not sound like a big deal,
well,
but...
I'm just trying to find, like, the actual use of
Well, it's just really telling us more about our universe, I guess.
Okay. So this new galaxy, is it a new galaxy that we found, or was it we always knew it was
no,
there?
No, well, it was always there. It was just that, you know, you can now... say, right, this particular neutrino was given out
was
by that particular galaxy, and that's, you know, and that puppy's been travelling for, you know, 4.5 billion years at the speed of light, you know, and it ends up in the South Pole. So, you know, we're seeing that as it was 4.5 billion years ago, essentially, which always amazes me. All the light that you see from the stars emanated from them, you know, hundreds, thousands, millions, billions of years ago in some cases. So, you know, always amazed by that. So, yeah, this is very, very cool.
Cool.
So,
all right.
No pun about the South Pole there. No.
Oh, yeah, that would have been a good one, actually. I'm still trying to understand exactly everything that you just said. Sorry. That's why I'm not very interactive today. But we can
not
move on to
not
a topic that I might have an input on. Who knows?
Yep.
So scientists have come up with a new tool that could help bring back all your old memories to life.
They could, as long as your old memories are daguerreotypes. Am I saying that correctly? It was named after a Frenchman, Monsieur Daguerre.
Daguerreotype, I think, is how we say it, but that's all right. that was close enough,
well,
really.
No, it wasn't. It was terrible. Okay, so back in the early days of photography, in which the French were instrumental, essentially the first type of photography were these things called daguerreotypes, sorry.
That's all right.
And they... kind of use the same principles as I was going to say modern photography, but now that it's all digital,
film?
I mean film. Yeah. So it uses sort of the same, certainly chemical principles anyway. But the big difference that was that daguerreotypes were done on solid silver, okay, and the silver was generally on a copper background or something, but they were taken on solid silver. So these things were actually plates, and they were. Not particularly strong, so you could, you know, just a touch could actually wreck them and everything. So very, very sensitive and very, very fragile things. And the big problem with them was that because they're made of silver, they were prone to tarnishing. And so these came out, I think the first daguerreotype was around about 1837. So you can imagine that these old things would be very, very interesting from a historical point of view. Anyway, you know, this is the foundations of photography, and so we can get to see, you know, photos from hell, you know, 160, 70, 80 years ago. But as I say, the problem was that a lot of them are in very, very poor condition now, and there's no obvious way to clean them up, given the fact that they're so fragile in the first instance. How are they made? So, as I said, they were made by getting this sheet of silver, very, very finely ground sheet of silver, so it's very, very highly polished. You then expose it to iodine vapor. Mm-hmm. And what that does is turn the silver into silver iodide. And that's a compound. And silver iodide is what we call photosensitive. In other words, if you shine light on it, it goes dark.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's very, very similar to the normal photographic process, where in fact they use silver bromide, but what they do is they impregnate your photographic paper essentially with that.
Yep.
Okay. So similar kind of thing. And then what they do, they develop this using mercury vapor, which is not the best for you. So
no.
they take this thing after they've got the silver iodide, they put it in the camera, they expose it to the light,
mm-hmm.
they then develop it using this mercury, and it's the presence of the mercury there that's all important, because what a chemist actually in Canada has done is to now use a thing called a synchrotron to take these very, very badly tarnished daguerreotypes, mm. which you really couldn't see anything of. You had a look at the pictures on...
Yes,
yeah,
I did.
Yeah, and it's utterly extraordinary what they've done. You really couldn't make out any picture. And what they do in this thing called the synchrotron is that they shoot very, very high energy X-rays at the daguerreotype. And they can then figure out where the mercury is on the plate. Okay, now, in regions of very, very light... area, there's lots and lots of mercury particles. In the dark areas, there's not very much mercury at all.
All right.
And so from the way that those X-rays interact with the daguerreotype, the different amounts of mercury in there, they can then build up a picture, literally, of what...
negative.
Yeah, essentially, yeah, yeah. Cool. So of where the mercury is on the daguerreotype, and then basically make a picture from that.
That's
so
very impressive.
They're not physically cleaning up the actual daguerreotype, but
they're
just recreating. Yeah, they're recreating it in digital form, and so they can see actually what's under all the crap. And as I said, the photo and the story on this was absolutely incredible. The only trouble. Okay, so synchrotrons are expensive puppies. There's about, I don't know, there might be 20 on the planet maybe, something like that.
Okay.
The closest one is in Melbourne to us.
Yes.
And you have to fight literally for time on these things. Getting 24 hours on a synchrotron means that you work for 24 hours, you don't sleep for 24 hours.
How long would it take per picture?
Well, that's the thing. So according to the work that this chemist did, this is 8 hours per square centimetre. So if these things are of any sort of size at all, then it's going to take an awful amount of time on an awfully expensive and large and well-used instrument to be able to do this. But...
Because who would have used it? Who would have wanted to use it? I suppose whoever works on old, like restoring old photographs, or
I would imagine so. Yeah, that sort of thing. But
they can't afford it.
Museums aren't the richest.
It's not the matter of affording it, because what happens? You can sort of ask for time on these things, and they give you in inverted commas the time. You don't have to pay the actual cost for these things, because they are upkept by often it's the government who keep these things going. So it's just the sheer amount of time and the sheer number of people who need the time on these things. So your old holiday snaps and stuff like that ain't going to work on those. But certainly these things that are of historical importance and are in very, very bad shape, I think this is an absolutely wonderful technique that has been used. So this was just published last week in the literature, and I'm sure that this is going to get a lot of attention. It'll be interesting to see whether they can sort of apply it to other things as well.
Well, I was going to say, because it's obviously going to mainly be used for that daguerreotype photographs,
yeah.
which I suppose there isn't actually that many probably left in the world to look at.
Well, again, the people were sort of bemoaning the fact that possibly many of these have been thrown out because they were thought to be irretrievable.
Yeah.
But,
so there might be some hidden ones, some private collections or some...
Yeah,
okay.
One can only hope.
Yeah.
You could also potentially, I guess, use it for things like paintings. Often there are old paintings that are painted over something
multiple
else.
Multiple layers.
Yeah, and so again, that's a common way that they can figure out whether there's something underneath them. So they simply use these X-rays.
Mm.
What's under the Sistine Chapel?
How we would like to know.
So I think that's a very, very nice application of really big science, because I guess non-scientists don't possibly appreciate the sort of work that can be done by these very, very expensive machines.
So, nice crossover of art and science.
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. You know, no, the two are definitely related. So. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Thanks. So last topic of the day, we are talking about bread. I'm actually really excited about that because I was watching this Netflix documentary the other day about bread. Yeah. And sourdough, and it was so fascinating about, you know, the ancient way, I suppose, of making bread.
Yeah.
I learned a lot about bread, and now you're going to tell us a bit more about how old it actually is.
Well, this is really interesting too, and this just got published again last week in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, which means it's very, very important. And so there were a bunch of archaeologists from Denmark and the UK, and they were excavating a site in northeastern Jordan in a place called the Black Desert. And they came upon the remains of a fire, and so they were looking at this, and in addition to things like animal bones and stuff like that, they managed to pick up, I think, around about 20-odd bits of bread, basically, which were equating it to the sort of things that you find at the bottom of your toaster, so when you don't clean it out for too long.
Crumbs.
Yeah, so little crumbs of bread. And so they subjected everything to C14 labelling, radiocarbon dating, to try and figure out how old this was. And what they found was a date of around about 14,000 years ago. So this bread is 14,000 years old. Yeah. And this is a big thing because it's been thought that bread sort of came along with settled societies, because obviously making bread, baking bread, is a labour-intensive thing. Yeah. It's not the sort of thing that you can really do on the move, because you've got to harvest your crops, you've then got to grind it all into flour, you've got to have a mill, an oven, all of those sorts of things. And so it was thought that the oldest sort of historical evidence for bread was around about 8,000 BC.
Okay, yeah.
And that was when the hunter-gatherers had sort of stopped moving around, and when society had started sort of living in small communities and stuff. And now this sort of throws that into question, because now this dates at around about 12,000 BC. And so this is 3,000 years earlier than people had thought before. So it potentially a very, very big finding, and it might cause people to rethink things. You know, how did they go about making the bread when they're on the move all the time? As I said, you know, very, very sort of labour intensive, and not the sort of thing that you'd expect.
So are we thinking like different technique potentially to make bread, or...?
Potentially, who knows, really? That's, you know, that's the question that the archaeologists are going to have to answer.
Did it say anything about the composition of those breadcrumbs?
Yes. So they found sort of plant fibres in there that could have been. They couldn't say it definitely, but they said that it probably contains that barley, wheat, or oats. So, you know, the sort of things that you would expect. Mm. So, you know, a very, very fascinating discovery, and certainly for that part of the world, I guess bread does have a sort of a large importance, certainly sort of religiously, I guess, you know, culturally and everything. So
and it's just everywhere, really.
Yeah. So I think that's a nice little thing to talk about, and possibly to end on.
All right. So yeah, we'll let you go back to your classes. Have they started again?
Yes, they have started again. I've got a lab from 1:30 to 3:30 this afternoon, foundation chemistry lab. So we're going to be heating up magnesium and that, and burning it.
Ooh, cool.
They're going to love it.
All right. Hope your students are as excited as you are to talk about that. And we'll see you next week.
Okay,
thanks,
Lisa,
for coming.
Not a problem. See you guys.
Cheers.
See
thanks.
That was Dear Science.